The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Rainmaker FM.
And welcome back to another Writer File. I am still your host, Kelvin Reed, here to take you into the minds, the habitats, and brains of renowned writers. And in part two of this file, the award-winning New York Times bestselling author, investigative journalist, all-around madman Scott Carney returns to talk about the dangers of putting yourself into the story, what he's learned from 20-plus years in mainstream publishing, and how he juggles his multiple creative adventures. Throughout his globe-trotting career, Scott spent extensive time in South Asia, been a contributing editor at Wired for over 5 years, and written for Mother Jones, Men's Journal, Playboy, Discover, Outside, Fast Company, and many others. Mr. Carney is the author of a trio of nonfiction books that combine investigative journalism and anthropology. His titles include The Red Market, A Death on Diamond Mountain, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, What Doesn't Kill Us? How Freezing Water, Extreme Altitude, and Environmental Conditioning Will Renew Our Lost Evolutionary Strength. As part of the research for What Doesn't Kill Us, Scott spent time with Dutch extreme athlete and fitness guru Wim Hof to try to understand the science behind his now famous method to control his body temperature in extreme conditions and tap into ancient superhuman abilities. In addition to his writing, Scott's a public speaker and educator whose work has been featured on NPR and National Geographic TV. His most recent project is a video course for writers called The Fine Print. It's aimed at helping freelancers, journalists, and creative entrepreneurs think of themselves as a startup business to help merge their creative and business sensibilities. Stay tuned to the end of the show for a special discount code just for listeners of this podcast. In part two of this file, Scott and I discuss tips for escaping the great distraction machine and focusing on only what's in front of you, why the author's whole life has been built around writer's block, Scott's routines for successfully juggling multiple large writing projects, how the author uses investigative journalism to actualize his ventures and vice versa, the importance of making a living versus writing simply for your own pleasure, and why he wants to take Hemingway to rehab. If you missed the first half of this show, you can find it in the archives, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you tune in, and in the show notes. Stand by. The Writer Files is brought to you by the all-new Studio Press Sites, a turnkey solution that combines the ease of an all-in-one website builder with the flexible power of WordPress. It's perfect for authors, bloggers, podcasters, and affiliate marketers, as well as those selling physical products, digital downloads, and membership programs. If you're ready to take your WordPress site to the next level, see for yourself why over 200,000 website owners trust Studio Press. Go to rainmaker.fm/studiopress now. That's rainmaker.fm/studiopress. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click subscribe to automatically see new interviews as soon as they're published.
Are you a headphones guy? Do you listen to music? Do you do white noise? Do you do any audio?
No, I need silence. I have pretty bad ADD. And so any external anything, and you sort of totally lose track. I can't focus on anything. What I did find is that there's this program called Self-Control. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It turns off the internet to your computer, right? Because I always find myself on Reddit or Facebook or any of those the whole internet is a distraction machine, right? Yeah. So there's this thing called self-control where you can set, your internet shuts down, or just selected sites on the internet shut down for, any time period that you select. So half an hour, an hour, or something like that. And I find that I can be, after procrastinating for a while, I can be hyper productive for like 15 or 20 minutes, which will get most of my word quota done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand with, and I'm pretty sure that self-control, if you're not joking, is similar to an app called Freedom, I think, which does much the same thing. But it just goes kind of hand in hand with almost like a Pomodoro method, where you're setting a timer and restricting yourself to really only get words onto the page, and you get so bored after the first 5 minutes that you have nothing really to do right? than to just get the words down. You can't move, you can't, you know, go get a coffee refill, you can't check your Facebook, which I've recently deleted. I still have an account. I just deleted it from my phone, so I don't. Right. So I don't. I'm not
tempted. You're a little happier.
Yeah, I think so. Notifications are a productivity killer for sure. Well, have you ever run up against writer's block, or do you believe in it? Is it a malady, or is it a made-up thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that writer's block certainly has happened to me, like where you can't get words on, where I can't get words on a page, or I just couldn't get really bad ideas. But I sort of feel like my whole life is arranged around writer's block, right? This is why that Pomodoro method or the Scrivener, the self-control or freedom is so important, is that my natural state is procrastination. and so giving myself focused time sort of does break out of it. But I've never had a thing where I couldn't write a word for like 6 months at a time. Like that's never occurred to me. And I really hope that it doesn't, because that would be a career killer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about workflow. I'm going to guess that you're a Mac guy.
Yes.
And it sounds like you lean on Scrivener for stuff.
Oh, I love Scrivener. Yeah. I mean, I don't use all its functions, but Scrivener, especially for larger projects, it just organizes things so well. And then other than that, I use Google Docs for a lot of stuff too. Because I really like the sharing mode on Google Docs, where, you know, I work, for instance, with this colleague of mine who's in Oslo, and we do, you know, one project every couple of years together. And it's really useful to have Google Docs open. You have that whole that sort of article in it, and then you can just see what each other are doing as you're writing, which is just mind-bogglingly amazing and useful.
Yeah, unless your cohort is trolling you.
Yeah, which he does sometimes, that asshole.
You know, I think the term productive procrastination was coined by Austin Kleon, who's a graphic designer and a writer. He wrote a book called Steal Like an Artist. And, you know, his whole thing was to always have three or four projects going at the same time. It sounds like that's kind of your Ken, and doing that, I think, you know, allows your brain to incubate ideas for that illumination piece while you're working on one thing. Your brain obviously is kind of doing stuff in the background in that kind of, what is that, the default mode in neuroscience. So it sounds like you kind of just lean into it and you let procrastination help you.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, that's really interesting. The way you put it almost makes me sound really like I planned it out really well.
Let's roll with that.
I think it's sort of, there's this natural ADD where I am always, you know, turning to the next shiny thing. So I've surrounded myself with like eight shiny things that I can turn my attention to. And yeah, it's better when it's not just surfing the front page of Reddit, right? You know, it's like, oh, I'll do this. And and you know, I find that there's also two very different types of project that I'm working on, right? There's that development phase where something's the idea, which is, you know, sort of just trying to get an idea into a full-on assignment, you know, in go mode. And I rarely have, you know, more than one total focus project alive at any one time, right? Right now I'm working on this book called The Wedge, and I have to have it, you know, released. I have, you know, the manuscript needs to be done in October. And that's the only main project I have going, but I'm pitching nine different projects probably. And they're all sort of long-term, and I can sort of slate them in so that when I finish this manuscript, I can just go right over into the next one as sort of the full-time thing. And I, you know, I have some small things like this video course takes, you know, a little bit of time, but it's something that doesn't, you know, it doesn't sort of take control of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you work out of a dedicated office? Do you work kind of out in the wild? It sounds like you work in an office because you need that focus.
Yeah, I have a standing desk in my office in my house. And so a lot of my life is just at a normal computer with a desk and all that stuff. But I take a lot of breaks in the day. I'll go outside. I do some workouts during the day, sort of like short 15, 20 minute workouts, and then come back and go back into working. I'm not really someone who believes that you need to put in 9 hours a day. I'm more of a person who feels like you need to get a certain amount of project success done in any one day. Mm-hmm. And then once that's done, your day is free, right? So if I finish my 500 words and I feel like good with that at 9 a.m., because I work from 8:30 to 9, I feel no guilt going out on a hike or a bike ride for the rest of the day. I feel and then if you plan long enough, right, especially with a book, right, you can say, I have to have this book done in 12 months. That 500 words a day goal is way more important than I sat in my desk 9 hours a day, right, and produced who knows how much, because you need that book in a fairly long period of time. And you can, your book project should, hopefully give you enough money between advance and royalties that it's a sustainable model.
Yeah, I just am a little curious about, I think, kind of your experience with this last book, What Doesn't Kill Us.
Right.
You kind of talk a little bit about kind of where you were coming from and, how you were kind of trying to really debunk the Wim Hof method, right? As, kind of a charlatan. And ultimately found that it was, rooted in science. And so how has that affected maybe your productivity as a creative person? Have you adopted, as you mentioned, kind of a different productivity mode where those breaks are ultimately more important to you than they used to be? Are you doing any breathing exercises? Are you, now I'm kind of curious about, and I know you've talked about kind of obviously the body mind connection, and how interested Silicon Valley is in that whole thing. And I'm sure that they're approaching, you and Wim Hof about kind of, how they can monetize ideas into an app.
There are some apps coming out on that, but I'm not involved with them.
No.
And now you're making me think, oh, another shiny thing to pursue. Right?
Oh no. But in all curiosity, I think just because of your background as a journalist and kind of your integrity, obviously it doesn't sound like, that's the route you would go, but it does seem, like a natural progression for you to kind of find, we're learning more about, nootropic stuff, and kind of you're talking about biohacking, and I'm wondering, as a writer, like how are you incorporating some of the things that you've learned into keeping you like focused and keeping the cursor moving?
So when I started this career, it was hardcore investigative journalism, right? It was infiltrating organ traffickers and organized crime. I was doing stuff in war zones. I, had, various points where I was like guns pointed at me, which I didn't like very much.
Really?
I was very much chasing these really big and potentially dangerous stories that occurred on sort of the fringes of what any, what most people think is ordinary. Although in those worlds, they had the sort of ordinary logic to them, which is super fascinating. And so the first two books that grew out of that investigative career, from going from feature stories into books, were all about, I'm going out, I'm going to go find the bad guy and get him to tell me his secrets, and I'm going to write the thing about him, which was sort of adversarial in nature, which is fine. Like, that's a totally okay mode to write in. But when I did the in that adversarial mode, the other thing that you need to do is you need to empathize with the people you're writing about. So, even if I'm talking to like a mob boss who's, has a murder record, I'm trying to get him to admit that he murdered people on tape, I still need to like empathize with where they're coming from and try to understand the world through their eyes, or else I'm going to do a terrible job representing why these things happened. Mm-hmm. And which means to some degree, you have to give even the murderer a fair shot, right? You have to even give that bad guy a fair shot to like explain where they're coming from.
Sure.
And with What Doesn't Kill Us, like it started out, I'd just written a book about how, you know, this Tibetan guru, American Tibetan guru in Arizona, was teaching a type of meditation which promised superpowers, and how that promise ended up getting people killed. That's the really short version of that, of you know, the book that I wrote called The Enlightenment Trap. Hmm. And then I heard about Wim Hof. Now, Wim Hof was making these claims that he could sort of exist on icebergs in his underwear, and he could control his immune system with the power of his mind, and, you know, cure every disease known to man. And I was like, this guy is total horseshit, right? He's just saying the same stuff as these other, you know, charlatans that I've exposed, and it'll be a pretty easy job for me to go in there and expose him. So I went out there with the intention of saying, you know, here's another sort of charlatan out there. And he wasn't super famous at that point. He was sort of a pretty unknown fitnessy guru guy. Hmm. But, you know, as the method of any sort of journalist with integrity, I still have to give him a chance. So I went there, I tried his method, and lo and behold, it worked, which totally blew my mind.
Yeah.
You know, within a week, I was sitting on this bank of like a river in Poland. You know, this is the middle of the winter that stopped the Nazi army in the 40s, right? And I'm melting the snow around me with my body heat. So I was like, well, this is bananas. This is great. And, you know, from there, I did, you know, a number of other sort of adventurous-y feats. And then I tried to understand how it all worked. And so just from the perspective of being honest as a reporter, I investigated this thing, which is truly amazing and groundbreaking. And I knew it had to be a book. You know, after that week, I was sure I would write a book. And it just took me 6 or 7 years to finally get that book out. You know, the article ran in Playboy, and it got a lot of attention and all that stuff. And that Wim Hof in that intervening time had also became sort of this international superstar. So that was very convenient for me to be someone who knew him at the very beginning of his sort of international career.
Yeah,
and then wild. Be able to release a book with it. And that, so that now your second, you know, you're sort of the other part of your question, which is like, how has that changed my writing method and my career now? Is that now that I found this sort of really cool entry point into my own physiology, I'm using this stuff all the time. And I'm going on, instead of these adventures, which are really adversarial, where I'm going out to prove someone's wrong, I hear about something which sounds really promising, and I go out and I try it. And, you know, sometimes the stuff doesn't work, right? Sometimes, like you mentioned nootropics, I've been underwhelmed by the nootropics looked at. But I have been really impressed by some exercises that I'm looking at, certain sort of environmental exposures. And I'm sort of just all wrapping that up into this next book, and it's going to be another adventure. So Scott still gets to do adventures, but I'm not getting as many guns pointed at me. So win-win.
There you go. All around. Well, you want to answer a couple creativity questions?
Yeah, shoot.
Okay. How does Scott Carney define creativity?
Oh, I don't know.
Perfect.
I guess just creating something, right? You know, but yeah, I don't really have a great answer, because I think everyone is creative in their own ways. And you know, there's one thing about having an idea, that however that idea, you know, genesis is from, you know, that's a creative in a very raw form. But I find that creativity and actually the actual creation of something is very mechanical, right? Once you have that great bit of inspiration, it's trying to translate that into you know, your form, right? Whether it's a sculpture or a painting or a, you know, in my case, a book or article. And that actualizing things is very, very difficult, and it requires discipline, and it requires, you know, a lot of the scut work that we don't always enjoy. Like I much prefer pitching ideas than I do actually completing them.
Yeah.
Because there's that sort of like, oh, potential in the idea coming in. And then there's the, oh, now I have to go fulfill this, which is way less fun.
That's interesting. You know, yeah, because so many writers say they enjoy the feeling of having written, but they don't actually like writing. And mm-hmm. That's a pretty common theme, I think. So, yeah, I mean, that's the creative muse, right? When those ideas are kind of coming to you, out of the ether. Do you have a muse that you're following? It sounds like the kind of the adventure of a lifetime that you're kind of on right now.
So how do you define muse? I find that really interesting.
I'm not thinking of it in a traditional sense. I think every writer and every creative has something, some seed that they follow. You know, I think, writers like a famous storied writer that wrote Bright Lights, Big City, Jay McInerney, has written about New York City most of his life. And, I asked him, what's the muse? He said, well, it's the city.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I think we all have different muses perhaps at different times in our lives. And some people just don't believe that it's even a thing.
Right. Like, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think that in the sort of the Greek understanding of it, right? It's sexual energy that goes into that as well, right? Mm-hmm. It would be like you have a woman, or in some cases a young boy that you had the sexual attraction to, but didn't actually actualize in reality, and then turn that into your creative potential. I don't have that.
Okay.
I'm not really eager to get that either. But I like what you're saying. Could New York City be your muse, or in my case, maybe having crazy adventures be a muse? But then, that also gets very diffuse, doesn't it?
Sure. Well, in your estimation, what makes a writer truly great?
Honestly, I think it's a nuts and bolts thing. I think a truly great writer is a writer who can make a living doing this, and where their writing and their creative potential and their sort of real world sustaining potential have met, and that you can sort of continue to do your work. I find that a really great skill and something that is underappreciated. Right? It's something that is not. People think that, someone is such a great wordsmith, right? Or I was talking to this writer when I used to live in California who told me he writes these books and then he just puts them out and he doesn't care if no one reads them. And I think that's crazy, I think, no, you write because you want a lot of people to read your work, and it has to find people. And the passion that you originally sparked it somehow inhabits that person. I think that's the great thing. And in order to get to that level in the modern world, you need to have very rational business practices. You need to treat it as to some ways a product, right? That's going out there and moves through sort of channels that eventually gets into the hands of readers, because not all of us are rediscovered after we die. For me, in some ways, the most depressing thing I can do is go into a bookstore and look at all of those books on the shelves and be like, oh my God, how is anyone going to find my thing? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you have a couple favorite authors that you're just kind of stuck on presently? Someone sitting on your nightstand, or any other authors that you admire?
What I'm reading right now is a lot of scientific papers, which are not inspiring, right? They're really interesting, but they're not super inspiring. I would say that my favorite, the writers that I admire most are the really interesting narrative nonfiction masters out there. Mm-hmm. I think Jon Krakauer is phenomenal. And I wrote one of my books with Under the Banner of Heaven right on my desk, right, where I would refer to passages of his and sort of try to inhabit some of his work. I find John Valiant's work amazing, the book The Tiger. In fiction, Ernest Hemingway, good old, fishing stories, stories of gain and loss. I mean, I find those very impassioning.
Do you, as so many writers and journalists, do you have just a kind of a best love quote hanging over your desk or etched into your mind?
I don't. I have a picture of a cutout of a tiger above my computer.
I like it.
From that I picked up in Thailand somewhere, and I don't know if that's inspiring, but I really do like cats.
It could be a totem.
Could be. Yeah. Maybe my spirit animal is a tiger. That'd be cool. That's a cool spirit animal, although it's probably a jellyfish.
So. Okay. So, yeah, before we wrap up with more information about the course and how to connect with you out there and any advice you have for your fellow scribes, we'll do one fun one. If you could choose any author from any era for an all-expense-paid dinner to your favorite spot in the world, who would you take and where would you take them?
Oh, man. I mean, so here's the question. Do you want to take them to a place that would amaze them or amaze you with the weirdness of it? Like, it'd be sure. cool to take Hemingway to like a crocheting class to see how he does, you know?
Do they serve wine?
Right, right. or maybe take him to rehab. You know, he probably needs to.
That's...
You know, you could have done so much more.
I snorted a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great story. But I'd love to have met Hemingway. And I, in theory, I could meet Krakauer because I think he lives in Boulder and I live in Denver. So that's something I go mountain climbing with Krakauer. It'd be really interesting. It'd be a fun way to fall off a mountain and then die. So,
as said many, a climber.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
I want to go in a Krakauer book. Before we point listeners to these great resources, do you want to just offer any advice to your fellow writers? I know, I mean, that's kind of goes hand in hand with your course, obviously. But just to kind of sum up what we've talked about here on just how to keep going.
Yeah, in terms of creativity, is you know, it's easy to get bogged down by the realities of the writing life, right? Is that when you're getting out there and you're like, how am I going to get you know, a contract, an agent, a you know, movie deal, book deal, whatever, or how am I even going to get into this magazine in the first place? It's really important not to take the whole project in your mind at the same time from start to finish. Like when I said that you should come up with ideas that could be movies or books, that's true, but you shouldn't immediately be trying to work on that movie part of it, right? Mm-hmm. So take it one day at a time, break up big projects into small manageable pieces and get a little bit done every day. And that adds up to big things over time. And you know, the more stressed out you get about, you know, finishing that project, the less you can pay attention to what's exactly in front of you and what you actually have control to work on right now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Great advice. We will point listeners to a handful of resources. You can start at scottcarney.com to find Scott's writing, more information about what he's up to, his books, links to his articles, and of course, this course that we mentioned at the beginning of the show, The Fine Print, and the course is designed to help teach you skills that journalism schools and MFA programs are afraid to teach, right? That's kind of mm-hmm.
Or they don't. I don't know if they're afraid to. They just don't teach you business skills. They teach you how to like worry about the ethics of what you write, which are important, and how to fact check and how to go out and report. But they don't talk about how to turn your words into money. They just sort of figure you'll get a staff job or you'll figure out on the fly. And it's a real disservice to people who are suddenly taking out $30,000-$40,000 in loans not to realize how to connect that creativity to you know, your bank account someday. And so, you know, negotiate and all of these are sort of parts of that business. So yeah, it's called The Fine Print. And the code that I'm giving away to people who are listening to this podcast is called Writer Files. Yeah, it's pretty easy to figure out. And that's 20% off the course. So it comes out to about $120 or something like that,
That's great. That's a nice resource for listeners. So again, that coupon code is Writer Files. Oh, all one word, excuse me.
Yeah, and in all caps because it didn't let me, you know, monkey with that. So
there you go.
And it's I think it's active until end of May.
All right. So listeners can go to courses.scottcarney.com. I'll post that link and get 20% off that course until May 31st of 2018. If you were listening to this show after the end of May 2018. Sorry, but the course is still great. It is, I got a chance to look at it. Check it out. Is there anywhere else you want to point listeners? I know you were on Twitter.
All of the places, right? You know, the Twitters, places. The Facebooks, the, you know, all that stuff. SG Carney, But, you know, any sort of Google search for Scott Carney, I usually come up at the top of that list.
Yeah. So. I love it, man. Well, thank you so much. And you know, I love the idea of merging business, creativity, kind of monetizing and the writer as startup. So congrats on all your successes. Best of luck, man. On all of the balls that you got in the air. We hope you get that roller coaster or at least at least a carousel with your name on it.
Oh, that seems more manageable.
But yeah, come back on the pod again and update us whenever you want. But it was great chatting with you.
Awesome. Will do. Thanks so much for having me, man.
Thanks so much for joining us for this half of a tour of the writer's process. If you enjoy the Writer Files, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts to help other writers find us. And for more episodes or just to leave a comment or a question, you can always drop by writerfiles.fm and chat with me on Twitter at Kelton Reed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.